You see, again, also as an HSP, as a highly sensitive person, my comfort zone is actually sitting on a mountain and meditating. Like what sounds to be torturous for a lot of people, you know, being in solitude and in stillness and alone is such a relief for me. It's easy for me. The hard thing for me is to be in the world. And so I think in each lifetime, we are given a different path in order to enrich our souls. But you know, if it's easy for you in this life, this is not your path.
Welcome to the first episode of the Ikivi Podcast Season 3. In this episode, we have with us Lisa Ray, an award-winning actor, author, cancer survivor, and co-founder of a digital art platform. Lisa has embraced multiple worlds and identities long before the mainstream accepted the multiplicities of selfhood. At 51 and a mother of 5-year-old twins, Lisa is a pro-ager working on her next book. She owns her narrative and encourages others to do the same through her public talks and keynote speaking engagements. In this wonderful conversation, we discuss motherhood, hustle culture, and the redefinition of societal systems. We also delve into the importance of having a unique voice in today's digital age, the impact of the entertainment industry on her personal life, and how she has redefined her career from being a 1990s model to the pivotal moments that have shaped the incredible person she is today. We truly enjoyed this candid conversation with Lisa and jump right into the thick of it as we begin. We hope you enjoy this conversation as much as we did.
So we started this a couple of years ago. I have always wanted to do a podcast on... I just enjoy conversations with people and I feel like people's stories are so exciting to hear. And they kind of hit me in some way or the other. And I just feel like people can get so much from regular conversations about people's lives and not nothing very intense, but just more like, what do they do in their lives? Like what kind of choices people make? Why are they choosing this over this? Like, I feel like those kind of things you only chat amongst your friends, but you don't necessarily hear people in society telling you these stories. And I feel like that's so valuable. Like one of my stories is, I enjoy chatting with like taxi drivers and anybody, like my gym trainer, about like taking care of children, right? And their perspective on things is so liberating in a lot of ways. Like, for example, I was constantly complaining that, you know, my daughter's waking up at night and I'm so tired during the day. And he's like, but yeah, that's just how it is for the first 3 years, like very calmly and casually. And I'm like, why am I stressing about it, you know? Like small things don't come to you very easily unless, you know, you actually look for these conversations. So I just hope that these
outside objective, right? And sometimes, again, not from within your own little echo chamber or your own little group of friends. It's so refreshing. And it's so refreshing to be able to connect on these universal experiences, like we were just adding about kid as well. And, you know, I was telling you, I'm in awe that, you know, you're the mom of an 18-month-old and you're carving out time and juggling as we all do, because I remember those days. Yeah. I mean, it was a blur. But, you know, we have to also share these stories, and it then becomes almost like a healing or a sense of support, like a support circle.
Because
again, it's something that's so universal. And the fact that we as women are suddenly expected to bounce back or reintegrate into society right after having children is, to me, so wrong and so goes against the, you know, the very basis of motherhood, of this deeply transformative experience. And I feel it's really disrespectful, you know? It's almost like taking something sacred and just sort of, you know, muddying it and being very dismissive with it.
I'm so curious as to why that's happening. Like, why are we not able to give enough credit to mothers and or be more understanding to them, because it's so, is it just like hustle culture or the Western world that's kind of saying, okay, you know, you can't just sit and take care of your child. You have to do this. Or is it something that we're talking from a place of privilege where we can actually have somebody to help us out while we can, you know, go to work and make money so that we can, you know, earn a living and those kind of things?
I think it's a little bit of both, you know. I mean, I'm a geriatric mom. Literally, that is how I'm categorized. I'm a geriatric mom and I own it. I had my kids when I was 46. Yeah, 46. Obviously via surrogacy because I couldn't carry them because of condition that I have. But I mean, so I've seen like maybe a wider spectrum of what there is in motherhood over these last 5 decades that I've been on the planet. And when I compare with my mother, I mean, my mother also worked, you know, and was ambitious. But when I look at how she juggled life, you know, between preparing home-cooked meals and, you know, little things like washing the laundry and, you know, putting it out to dry, not using machines and things like that. This was now, we're talking about Toronto in the 70s. And my father's Bengali, my mother's Polish, but my mom is like very rooted actually in Indian culture, surprisingly. And yeah, she's very aligned with India. And, you know, she did it all, but without maybe angst. If that makes sense, it was sort of an attitude that this is now part of life. Having a child is part of life. And I'm going to get on with it. I mean, it might be a little bit of her Eastern European also of cultural conditioning as well. But there was less angst. Maybe there was less choice. And I do think that hustle culture, that I personally am really vehemently against, like I don't even like using the word to be honest, has had something to do with this, with, you know, conditioning us, or, you know, making women, young women or women who are having kids now, internalize this idea that you can never take a break. And that is also, it's dangerous territory, because to be part of a rat race, we all know that there's a rat race. You know,
yeah,
we're conscious of that, and yet we still get entangled. We still become rats. So how do you step out of it? And I think that that is also tied up with ideas of worthiness, which, of course, women have been struggling with for decades and decades and decades, you know, struggling under the patriarchal thumb for so long. And now that we have a greater sense of liberation, a greater voice, a stronger voice in the world, I think that we are now at the mercy of our own internalized kind of critic and this ridiculous hustle culture. Something's happening, but whatever it is, it seems that there's always a mechanic in place to make women feel bad about themselves, no matter what it is, you know, it changes every decade. And I can't help but feel from what I'm seeing, like I said, young women, of course, young urban women, a sense of privilege and a sense of, you know, choice, I think, especially are vulnerable to this idea of like, I can't take a break. I've had a kid, but like, I need to get places in life. You know, I'm getting somewhere. I'm still ambitious. How am I going to continue to build my business, climb the ladder, become someone in the world by taking a break? I can't do that. I think that that's just such a unfortunate and dangerous form of thinking. You know, I don't think it serves us. And it's reactive. It's a reaction, obviously, to the generations that came before, where, you know, I mean, came from this very patriarchal kind of a notion that, oh, well, women are never going to become leaders because they have to bear children, they have to take time off, and they're going to have to take maternity leave and stuff like that and never regain their edge. But why are we not talking about just redefining this whole broken dysfunctional system?
Yeah.
You know, by again healing ourselves, putting ourselves, and now teaching our children something different, hopefully. I mean, I look at my daughters and they're 100 times what I was at their age. So they're going to be 1,000 it was. And there's a real chance to redefine things if we treat them thoughtfully.
Yeah.
If we, you know, the problem is the systems haven't kept up with everything that's changing, right?
Yeah.
Like the education system is still so far behind, woefully behind. Like there's another thing that's going on in my life now where I've identified that one of my daughters, I have twins. She's what I would qualify as a highly sensitive person.
Mm-hmm.
HSP, which is, I fall squarely in that category. And I never had the support when I was growing up. Nobody understood. I thought I was crazy. Mm-hmm. I thought I was crazy. That had me acting out because I was always overstimulated. I didn't fit in. I was seeking solitude. And, you know, that personality is often ridiculed and not valued.
Mm.
And I had to adapt. And it caused a lot of angst and a lot of internal pain. And then finally, I've unwound all of that. But now that I see my daughter, I'm way ahead of the game. And I'm, you know, taking her to see a counselor who knows how to help her cope with her emotions. Because she's an empath, feels a lot. Mm. She feels overwhelmed in certain situations where there's a lot of people. And the education system doesn't necessarily serve that.
Yeah.
And we know about it. So we've got to create those boundaries. This is just like, you know, kind of, I don't know, I'm sorting through all of this. I just don't want her to go through what I went through.
Yeah.
For sure. And I think that goes for all of us mothers, right? We just want something better for our kids. So, you know, the fact that we're, you know, you're going through this period of time right now as a young mother where you're feeling overwhelmed, which is natural. Mm-hmm. I was overwhelmed. Like, I think I was in shock for the first 2 years, to be honest, because I do.
Oh my God. I don't know how you did that.
I was in a daze, you know, and that's natural. We need to be able to tell each other, like hold each other and say, that's okay. That's natural.
Yeah.
And even if society doesn't support that, we've got to actually tune that out. And say, sorry, mm-hmm. we want better. Like, we demand something better. And we demand something better for, like, our daughters and our sons and the next generation.
I do want to talk about being a highly sensitive person. But just to quickly go back a little bit about talking about the rat race and us kind of, as mothers, stepping back and giving ourselves permission to take that break. How has that been like for you, especially in the industry that you are in? Has that had an impact in your career, positively, negatively, or how has that played a role for you?
See, I mean, just to give context, I call myself an accidental actress because it's a fact. It's not just sort of like a cute little subtitle to give myself. I never wanted to be an actor. I fell into it literally by accident and off of the back of actually some very traumatic circumstances. So I've always struggled with it. Now, however, of course, it's opened up entirely new worlds that I probably wouldn't have had access to. But now, so many decades along the line, again, people tend to forget.
Mm-hmm. Obviously,
because I'm so young. But people tend to forget I've been doing this a long time.
Yeah.
So there's a certain amount of also, not jadedness, not cynicism, but okay, been there, done that, you know?
Mm.
What is the next creative challenge? And I simply don't feel very challenged in the industry today because it's also evolved in such a way that it doesn't suit a very highly sensitive person like me because I find today sets extremely stressful, constantly surrounded by people, by an entire team of people, and it takes a toll on me. So I think also with the combination of circumstances, one being having been diagnosed with cancer a number of years ago, that obviously was a big reckoning and transformation in my view of life. Secondly, being able to have the guts to actually pursue other channels of creativity, like writing is something that's been really important to me. I wrote my first book. I'm working on the next one. that's obviously a profession very highly suitable to an HSP as well, who wants to spend long hours of contemplation alone. I co-founded a digital art platform at the beginning of this year. So I find that I'm able to obviously pursue other things, other interests that I wanted to, and for whatever reason, didn't get a chance to before. Now, in terms of the actual industry, I think that stepping back from it was for sure conscious. And I never say never, but, you know, because occasionally, as soon as I say, okay, I'm retired, then something really interesting will come up. Like Four More Shots literally came out of the blue and landed in my lap. And so my best projects have happened that way, but I've never been part of the hustle culture of the entertainment world. Like, I don't even know how to do it. I wouldn't even know how to do it. So I have a very different kind of career graph, and it's one that I personally own and I'm happy with, but probably wouldn't suit other people because you're not in the mix all the time and not, you know, forward and front and in front of everyone's faces. So it's been okay for me. I think for sure there's been an impact, maybe, but more, I would say it's more because I've made myself a little bit inaccessible and chose to step away. But I think what's interesting in today's entertainment scenario is that there's, first of all, a lot more different possibilities for actors to fit within the traditional stereotypes. And also, I think that because we all have a potentially a voice and a platform and we can share our unique voices, that, you know, an audience will tend to anyways gravitate towards also who you are as a person and what you stand for. So that creates completely different, like a different audience and a different stream of being able to, you know, maybe create content independently as well today, right? There's so many more possibilities than there were when I started. And, but having said all of that, I wouldn't trade any of it for where I am today because I really, really prioritize my family and my kids and my lifestyle and the boundaries that I've created around myself. I still love, like, for instance, for me, I'm still very active on, like, say, a motivational speaking circuit. I still do a lot of appearances. I still do a lot of work around cancer and wellness. And I'm super passionate about that. And I'm happy to drop anything and jump on a plane and give a talk to a live audience. That actually gets me much more excited than being on a set for 12, 14 hours a day right now. So I sort of redefined my career. And my career has always been kind of like an octopus moving in many different directions. But I do think that society still punishes you. Let's get to the heart of it. It will still punish a woman who, first of all, prioritizes family.
Yeah.
And secondly, prioritizes herself. You know, there's a saying, and like I'm really bad at actually spitting out sayings, but there's a saying which is that there's nothing more dangerous and threatening in society than a woman who is confident and knows herself. Not be influenced or swayed. Because if you, everything in our life today is targeted at creating some insecurity or a sense of lack.
Do you think all of this comes with maturity and comes with age? Because you're a lot more experienced in life. You've dealt with a lot more, you've dealt with life a lot more because we still are, you know, affected by what society thinks. We're still affected by what our friends and family think. Do you think that comes with age, understanding that? Is that just a part of life?
It is so awesome on this side. I can't even come to this side. Don't be fearful of this side. You know, ever since, I mean, I thought turning 40 was revolutionary, but turning 50 has been
something else.
Oh my God. But let me say, I mean, I can only speak from my personal experience. And I've had, I think, an unusual life in the sense that I did everything from the perspective of I got everything out of the way. I would say I have no woulda, shoulda, coulda left in my life. Do I still have ambitions? Yes, absolutely. I want to become a Booker Prize winning author. Yes, there's many other things. I want to still give a lot of talks, maybe do the occasional interesting project. Yes, I still have ambitions. I still have a mission, you know, a sense of like things that fire me up, that get me excited every day. But that restlessness that plagued me when I was younger, that's definitely now settled. Extremely restless. I was a very different human being when I was young. Like people who knew me probably in my 20s would not actually recognize me today. They would not be able to reconcile the two versions of me. So I think that, you know, as a woman, often we have two choices. Either you get married young and, you know, start your family young. And then I think you go, you kind of throw off all the shackles probably at a certain age and like, okay, now's my time to enjoy life. I did the opposite. I got everything out of the way. And then I got married at 40. And then obviously then had my children much later in life. But in my case, I think it worked for my personality because, as I said, I feel I've gotten so many things out of the way. I don't have a sense, like a niggling sense that I'm missing out on something. I have no FOMO. I'm JOMO at this point in my life. And it's because I literally, you know, had a taste of everything that I had set out for myself and then some. And also experienced a lot of drama, a lot of it unnecessary as well. And, you know, all the usual things, the heartbreaks, the huge highs and the lowest of lows. And, you know, and it almost feels like a different lifetime now. And I enjoyed all of it, even the lows. And I don't regret a single moment of it because it brought me to where I am today. And it really, I've landed in a greater sense of peace. And that's the priority. It's easier. There's clarity then because I don't get as muddled because I'm not taking on a lot of society's opinions anymore. Do I occasionally get influenced? Okay. Yeah, one does. You know, if you are on any sort of social media, I think it's really hard to say that you don't at some point get affected. So I tend to try to switch off. But you just know yourself so well. And it's sort of like a done that attitude, as I said, that I don't get as badly influenced. And I feel I accomplished a lot of things that I wanted to accomplish before having children. Mm-hmm. So much benefit. I think it's really tough on young women today. You're expected to do everything, everything. Have to have the career and the success and the independence and at the same time balance out, right? A traditional family. Like, how the hell are you supposed to do that? Explain it to me.
I have no idea. Who
set these rules?
Yeah.
That's the thing. Who set these rules? Let me say one thing. I wanted to address one thing really quickly that I've actually been thinking about is this idea of relevance. Who the hell decides whether we're relevant?
What?
Like what? And what is relevance?
Yeah.
Is it? I always think of, you know, there's that movie, The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
And that little man sitting behind the curtain who's like, I mean, who's the wizard?
Yeah. Who's setting it all up?
Who's setting it all up?
Yeah.
And again, at a certain age, it becomes such a relief to be able to like let that go. I have found, I'm sorry, I have found in my life that the best things that I've ever put out there, shared, or accomplished have happened from a sense of authenticity when I've let of a lot of fears. Doesn't mean that there wasn't fear that started out, but when I've let go of a fear or, you know, these ideas of, am I being relevant? Am I still kind of cool? Am I still the it girl? Stuff like that, you know, all that stuff that, because I was at one point in my early 20s, but that's gone. It doesn't affect me now. And it gives me such a freedom.
Can you tell us a little bit about that, about the 1990s and being a model and what life was like? I think in an interview, you had mentioned that it was almost as being a model in the 90s was almost as celebrated as being a Bollywood actress. I'd love to hear what your experience was like in the 90s and also what kind of what are those moments, those pivotal moments that led you to becoming this beautiful person that you are today with so much clarity, with so much intention in your life? What led you to be this person?
Okay, I'll talk about the 90s first. I mean, I have, of course, shared a lot of my perspective on the 90s in a book that I wrote, Close to the Bone. So I still invite anyone who's interested, it's not just about that, obviously, but to read the book. Oh my God, it's so hard sometimes to reframe it because it was a completely different era in so many ways from what the entertainment industry is today, even from what Bombay is today. If you can imagine, though, for a certain period of time in the 90s, Bombay, because that's what it was called then, was more liberal than it is today in terms of people's mindsets. And you see, Bollywood was still seen as something that was, I mean, definitely from girls from good families was disgraceful, was not an industry that you wanted to associate yourself with. And it was, you know, the early 90s was just the blossoming of, first of all, the liberalization, the steps towards the liberalization of India, and then secondly, also advertising. Mm. So advertising in India was going through its heyday because of the sort of caliber of talent that was attracted to advertising. Because in those days, I think someone put it really well, I think it was Mahesh Mathai who said, we were doing great ads for poor products, whereas today you're doing poor ads for great products. And I don't know, it's just a series of circumstances that brought together a whole bunch of people who are creatively very open-minded and adventurous and talented. And it was really advertising and fashion where you could expand your wings. And also it was obviously where a lot of English speakers gravitated towards. Bollywood was seen to be a place where, I mean, I'm not disparaging, you know, people who don't speak English at all. Please don't get that wrong. But it was simply seen as a place where there was a lack of sophistication.
Mm.
And such a set formula in how they did things that there was little chance to play with the formula and to be creative. So, as I said, all the dreamers and the creatives were attracted to advertising and fashion. In a sense, there was a bunch of us who were setting the foundation of the industry as it is today. You know. Whether it was Rohit Bal or James Ferreira or Tarun, Wendell had just come back to India. And there was quite a few people who had left India and were just returning and taking these new ideas and trying to integrate them into the Indian advertising scene. Farooq Chotia, great new, you know, young makeup artists as well. And I just sort of smack landed in the middle of this unknowingly.
But how exciting.
I was very excited by it because I have always been creative. And even as a model, there was a certain level of respect for a certain period of time where I think there was a group of us. And you might say, and this might sound a little egoistic, but, you know, it's okay. I'm going to put it out there where, you know, you had the 90s supermodels of like, Naomi and Christy and Cindy and, you know, that little gaggle of girls. And there was a group of girls in the 90s who were sort of, you know, also had as much renown and fame. And we did everything. We did every single ad, and they were ad films. And these ad films were actually, in that sense, such little pieces of art that people still recall them, which if you think about it, if people have a recall for an ad that was done in the 90s but can't remember an ad that they saw yesterday, that's something there. But remember what I was saying about the caliber of people. Like, for instance, A.R. Rahman was composing jingles.
Mm.
Caliber of talent.
Yeah.
We, as an example, though, you know, I was in demand for a certain period of time, and I was getting also Bollywood film offers. But if I waited out, I would earn a certain amount for 3 or 4 days to make an ad film and probably be flown off to an exotic location like Mauritius or Switzerland. And in order to do a film, it would probably take about 2 years.
Mm.
I might only be earning a little bit more than I would for the ad film because there was a lot of money in advertising in those days.
But was it for the fame then?
Sorry?
Was it for the fame then?
I think so. Well, you know, Bollywood just wasn't all that in those days. And yes, I mean, ultimately, I think you would be able to earn more money, maybe long term. But think about it. You would also, as a woman, have to be beholden to the hero. He was always the most important aspect of the film.
Mm-hmm.
The hero would be signed first, and then they would try to find a heroine whose dates would fit around the hero. And you have to always kiss ass. And I don't know. I don't have it in me. I pissed off more people than I ended up, you know, ingratiating myself to. And I also had my own reputation at that particular period of time. I was as renowned for a certain period of time as even any of these guys, and they were also chasing me. I couldn't justify it. Why would I sign off 2 years of my life and, you know, around also a hero who would be very also, you know, fickle and would decide to like cancel a shoot or, you know, decide that like, no, I don't feel like shooting today. It was much less codified and organized than it is today. I finally did end up doing a film because I really liked the script and it was female-centric and it was very unusual for those times. The other thing is I just couldn't see myself gyrating with Govinda. Like, I mean, I respect him. I respect what he stands for. It was just not me.
Yeah.
I did perhaps put myself on my own little pedestal and why not? And as I said, that was, you're always punished for that as a woman. I didn't play the game. And I didn't, as I said, you know, ingratiate myself to the right people, but neither did I want to. I didn't want to be a part of Bollywood. It was very, very far from my mind because I never grew up with Bollywood. It wasn't an aspiration.
Mm-hmm.
Modeling was always more interesting to me also because of the community and the people that I met and the things that we were able to do. And as a female model, I was, you know, it was actually people would hire me first and then figure out the male model. So it was like an inversion. It's not just me. There was a group of us, you know, there was Madhu Sapre, there was Meher. Ash came in first as a model. There was quite a group of us who were like these names that did everything. But it wasn't also about ego either. We would go off and experiment, you know, go off with photographers and do experimental art photography. We were really creatives. We were very taken by the creative process and it wasn't transactional and it honestly wasn't just about the money. I would say I was like the last of the flower children. It never was just money because I could have made even a lot more money in those days doing things that didn't suit me or didn't, you know, speak to me.
Thank you for listening to the Ikibi podcast. If you are enjoying listening to our podcast, do consider supporting us by visiting www.ikibi.com. That is ikkivi.com. We are a small sustainable business supporting contemporary Indian brands. Our platform is run by an all-women team handpicking the most beautiful, ethically made clothes and accessories from across the country, all in one place. Our podcast is self-funded and will always be free to listen to. You supporting our work would mean a lot to us. Thank you for being here and let's get back to our episode.
Did your upbringing in Canada have an impact on the way that you dealt with these situations in your life or made those choices in your life? And how did that play a role?
Maybe. I would think it was more my own particular upbringing, my parents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, of a mixed background at a time when there was nobody else that I could look up to. And, you know, and my father's very Bengali, you know, so he's always emphasized literary traditions, and he would only ever take me to see films that like were art films, you know? So that's what I valued much more than mainstream films. So I think that informed it. But you see, I was also basically alone in Bombay from the age of 16. And that created a real sense of independence and having to develop my own voice very, very quickly and stand up for myself. Mm-hmm. And I never experienced, fortunately, a kind of a We Too, you know, or a Me Too, sorry, a Me Too actual event in my life. I don't even know why. I don't even know why. I'm so lucky that I somehow or the other dodged it, because there was a lot of that going on, of course. But I think it's because, you know, I had a reputation at that time. I came in with a bang into the industry and I never had to go looking for work. So I was in more of a power position. But also, I think because I was very confident of just walking away from the situation.
Yeah.
So I think that it was circumstances that forced me to be very outspoken. And I just had a very different point of view. And as I said, I had nothing to lose because I never wanted to be part of the industry in the first place. I was happy to walk away. But I feel that as a woman, you should always have that attitude regardless. Even if something is important to you, you should still always put yourself in a position where it's okay. I can walk out of this situation. I don't need this. And that's a conversation. You should have more.
Yeah, I feel like that's something that we don't have as women, is the confidence, or we're always told to be kind of lesser or subservient in some ways to what somebody else is telling us. Like we second guess things. We don't have that confidence enough. How do you feel we can actually start making change in that sense? Like, or is there some particular moments in your career that you felt like, you know, this was when you were taking charge and this is a choice that you had to make?
Yes, I left India at one point because I felt thwarted. I felt like I was suffocated and nobody around me understood. Mm. I mean, having said that, I was in a very toxic relationship as well, but that wasn't the primary reason for me to leave. I just felt like there's more for me out there, and I valued my voice, and nobody wanted to listen to my voice in those days. They just said, she's just a glamorous woman and we've offered her lots of glamorous roles and she's refused them. So whatever. Mm. And the filmmakers who were doing the kinds of films that I wanted to be a part of, the Shyam Benegals or the, you know, people of that caliber, they wouldn't, entertain me. Because again, they had typecast me. All of them had typecast me, mm-hmm. both from the mainstream side and the alternative side. And I think as a woman, owning your identity is so important. So I really struggled with that. So maybe people today don't understand why I'm so sensitive about that, about being typecast or being called glamorous. I mean, today at 50, sure, I'll take it because, you know, it's been a full circle for me. But I was extremely sensitive as a young woman because, you know, again, it really diminished my voice. I mean, I was collecting art. I was writing. I had so many other ambitions. And I literally felt like my wings were being clipped. But not just that, it's almost like people were reacting with anger when I tried to show them different colors of my personality. They only wanted me to be who they thought that I should be. I was allowed this, like literally this, almost like this kind of shallow image that they had of me. Because I mean, listen, if you ask probably like a 45-year-old CEO, they'll still be like, oh yeah, Lisa Ray, I saw her on that cover, you know, like it was just a thing for people at that moment. And maybe it's because also people associate, you know, the cover of a magazine with who they were at that particular point in their life, that they don't want to let go of that, you know? I don't know. That could be a part of it. So I had to leave. I had to leave my comfort zone. I had to leave. Like, I literally walked out of my flat, locked my flat, and went to London and didn't look back for several years because it was hard for me. I was leaving a place where I was known, where I had status, where I didn't really have to work too hard, you know, for the unknown. That was tough. That was really tough. And I didn't have an exact plan, but I went to London and started a life as a student. I went to drama school, even though I didn't start out wanting to be an actress. I was intrigued by the process of acting, the methodology mm-hmm. of acting. Ever since I worked with Vikram Bhatt on this film that I did, Kasoor, because he really opened that up in me, that acting could almost be therapeutic. So I ended up going to acting school, but I also went and took courses in poetry, in art management. And, you know, I was in London and I was young and I was, you know, crisscrossing the city, just trying a little bit of everything. But I also ended up addressing my trauma that I had ignored for many, many years. And that was a big opening. And that also started, so it wasn't until my 30s that I started unwinding a lot of my inner world and mm-hmm. inner trauma and ignoring. So like for up until then, work was a way of distracting myself from my inner pain. Yeah. Pain is the greatest teacher in the world. Let me tell you that.
Now that you're telling us.
That was a pivotal point. So I'm looking back, I'm out of myself. And then after that, there was no stopping me. I literally went, and some of the things were probably insane that I did. Even I can say that. But, you know, when you remove that element of the world's judgment from your decision-making, I mean, it's beautiful. It's so incredibly liberating. And even if a decision you make doesn't work out, it's okay. Yeah. You move to the next thing.
Yeah. You've dealt with so much in your career and in your life. There have been lots of challenges and obstacles. What has helped you stay resilient and determined in the face of adversity?
I have to say my spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. My faith. I've always had like two parallel lives. There's the, you know, the worldly life, but, you know, alongside in parallel, I've always had, I've always been drawn towards spirituality. And I spent actually 1 6 months in a Tibetan monastery. And at the end of it, I actually wanted to become a Buddhist nun. And I sent out a mass email to everyone. Saying, okay, this is my decision. I found my place in the world. I'm super happy here. And I was going to do it. I was going to shave my head and don robes and take my vows. And then a friend of mine in London immediately sent me back a response. And in her subject line, it was like, top five reasons to become a Buddhist nun. Number one, sex. Number two, you know, la, 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 la. And it kind of broke the spell at that moment, even though I'm pretty sure I did it in a previous life. There was another, I had a spiritual mother at that time who also kind of helped me to reframe my experiences. Because you see, again, also as an HSP, as a highly sensitive person, my comfort zone is actually sitting on a mountain and meditating. Like what sounds to be torturous for a lot of people, you know, being in solitude and, you know, being in stillness and alone, is such a relief for me. It's easy for me. Mm. And, the hard thing for me is to be in the world. And so I think in each lifetime, we are given a different path in order to enrich our souls on the path. And I had a spiritual mother at that time. And I still remember I was so excited, you know, and I had a bit of a spiritual ego. I said, oh my God, I think I found my place for sure. I was a Tibetan monk in my last life. And I feel like I've come home and it's such a relief. And I think that this is what I should do. And she said in a very calm way, she said, good, good for you. But you know, if it's easy for you in this life, this is not your path. If it's hard for you to come down from the mountain, that's what you have to do. Because it's no big deal. She kind of popped my bubble. She's like, okay, found your place. But maybe the challenge is to take those learnings and those practices and apply it in the real world. And that really stayed with me. And I've tried to stay true to that. like even when I become highly overwhelmed, and I get overwhelmed very easily and quickly in the world, it's a challenge. It's a challenge to say, okay, it's okay. I can find my space here in this marketplace. I don't have to always escape to the mountains. Though sometimes that's really useful as well. Yeah. Very advisable to people. Like taking a retreat and carving out self-care time, super, super important. And again, that's something we don't talk about enough.
So do you have any spiritual practices that you do every day, or is it in part of your routine?
So I'm not as disciplined about my meditation routine as I was at one point in my life, because I mean, I just don't believe in dogma. I do meditate at least a few times a week, and I'm always happy when I do it, but I can't say that I do it every single day. There's a few people that I listen to. I love listening to Jack Kornfield, a Buddhist, an American Buddhist meditation teacher, Ted Grand, who started something called Modo Yoga, which was used to be Moksha Yoga, and I actually trained to be a Moksha Yoga teacher. And I find that his talks, he does like a talk and reads a poem and does 20 minutes of meditation. Sometimes it's really invigorating. Yoga, yes, whenever I get it, yes, please. We're just challenging with kids. Let's put that out there, right?
Yeah.
To get a very stringent routine is challenging. So I did not need another thing to make me feel guilty. Like, yeah. Oh, I've got a spiritual practice goal. But to be honest, the most useful thing, technique that I use, especially when I'm getting really tied up in knots or negative, is a very simple mindfulness exercise where I see the thought, and rather than getting tied up in the content of the thought or what I'm thinking, I say, oh, yes, there is thinking.
Mm.
Oh, yes, there is a thought.
Mm.
And it sounds so simple, and it is like the best things. It's elegant and simple, but it's not easy.
It's not,
but it
yeah.
just breaks a spell. For me, and if you, and it's something that you genuinely can integrate into your day-to-day life. You know, we all go off on these like, you know, dream journeys in our heads, right? Whether negative or positive, you know? I mean, the negativity kind of rabbit hole, everyone can relate to that. You're like, oh my God, why didn't I do that? And shit, and do I have time to do this? And da-da-da, and my life isn't looking how it did 3 years ago, and I'm so tired. And then all you have to do is like stop and just say, oh, there's thinking. Look, thinking. And it's literally like breaking a spell.
Yeah, I think it kind of like pulls away your emotions that get tied to something otherwise.
The charge. Yeah. That or the content of the thought. Content of the thought will keep changing. It will come and go just like weather.
Yeah.
It's like checking in with the weather of your head. And we all need that distance from our own thoughts, right? That's really what mindfulness is. It's being able to witness. And again, that is pure freedom. It's pure liberation. Yeah. So I really recommend that. Just sometimes walk around in your day, and occasionally, whether it's a good thought or a bad thought, forget categorizing the thoughts. Just say, oh, there's thinking.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. See that? There's thinking. There's that thought, or there's that thought again. Okay. And in fact, you end up having like a little bit of a laugh, and it's like a big reset. That's what helps me the most right now. I love going off on retreats. I used to go off on 2 week long retreats into Thailand or the deserts of California, and motherhood put an end to that. And you know, I love going and joining a woman's circle in the evening, and motherhood put an end to that because either I don't have the time or I'm too exhausted to think about doing it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I feel guilty, and I have to stop myself from comparing, right? There's always, the brain is always going to compare. Oh, I used to have time to do that. Yeah. Do you remember how chill I was, how zen I was? It's okay. Can find a different kind of a zen. Or I've adapted, like I find yoga classes that are much closer to me within my community. I find a bunch of girlfriends that we're all have kids the same age, and we sit and have coffee and just vent.
Yeah.
That's self-care right there.
Because I do feel like we need that to be mothers as well. We do need that zen-like life that was there before. I used to do meditation myself a little bit free prior to having my daughter. And then now I'm like, I need it more than ever because I know the value it has and the way it makes me feel. But now I'm like, okay, I have 30 minutes. I'm just going to go run on the treadmill. It'll give me the same boost that I need.
Yeah.
And just be done with it. Like, I'll deal with life. But I would love to hear what your self-care rituals are like, because I feel like we do need to prioritize it and have it kind of play a role in our day-to-day lives, which we're just not doing enough of and giving enough value to.
Yeah. First for me is boundaries. I mean, it starts and ends with being able to set really clear boundaries. Again, as someone who's very, very sensitive and gets overstimulated, and whose nervous system just kind of goes out of whack very quickly, boundaries. So like, for me, self-care is actually being able to say no to a social obligation and not have to explain why. I can't do noisy restaurants. I can't do big parties. And you know, that, again, can actually infuse you often, or people make you feel guilty or strange about that, or why are you so weird? So my self-care is like, I just kind of mute all of that out. And so boundaries also about like, okay, I need this time in the day to myself. I need to take a walk. I need to get away from my kids as well. You know, that's also part of self-care. I adore them to bits, but when it all gets too much, I'll, you know, either drive off and have a coffee on my own, meet a friend, take the dog out for a walk, go and play some tennis, whatever it is. I think right now, primarily, I mean, of course, sleep. Oh,
yeah. So
I almost don't even want to say this to you right now.
Don't.
Game changer. But here's the thing. My entire routine for the foreseeable future is going to sleep, like getting sleepy around 9:30 and crawling into bed and waking at 5:36. Why? Because my children are banging on the door.
Oh, gosh.
If they're not banging on the door, I can hear them. Or there's just like an internal alarm that goes off. And I enjoy the morning routine with them. So, you know, for all practical reasons, I've become a morning person, which means self-care means going to sleep early, which means barely going out. Weekdays, you know. And people who don't understand that, but that again comes down to boundaries and being able to drop the guilt around a lot of that. Self-care is swimming in the ocean. Self-care is immersing myself in nature. Really conscious and making conscious decisions every single day. Like, it doesn't have to be one moment because that's overwhelming. But like I think when you're aligned, and there's a certain clarity and alignment between your mind and your body and your soul, your decisions naturally flow from a place that they're going to support you. Like little things, for instance, you know, we live in Dubai, and when we first moved here, my husband got a place in Marina, which is a very busy, concrete-y place. And we had a very glamorous apartment, and I was miserable because I felt like a lack of nature, or I needed to be closer to the ground. And I explained it to him. And, you know, even before our lease was over, we moved into a place that I felt was like a lot more grounding. That's self-care, you know, it's being selfish. It's really like, again, putting your needs. And I also put my family's needs ahead of, you know, entwined, not let me say ahead, but entwined with mine, because I know that it's better for my kids to also be in a place where there's grass and outdoor space. That these are like little examples, little tweaks, but I think even before we talk about self-care, we have to talk about mental wellness and being able to carve out the time, because how do you know what's good for you if you haven't actually sat down and reflected?
Yeah.
And, you know, sat with yourself and say, what do I actually need? Yeah. Like, not what does this need? Like, what does this need? You know, what does my body need? What's my body saying? And we tend to, again, in today's world, is kind of a cult of the mind and the brain. And we're always head led. And, you know, we don't listen enough to our body. And our body speaks to us. Yeah. And our body's missed often than the mind.
Yeah, I feel like we just kind of go with the flow a lot of times. And then we deal with something terrible. And you're like, okay, hold on. Let me give this some thought and see if this is actually serving me well or not. And I feel like we don't do that enough, like you said. I feel like we do need to think about it on a weekly basis or a monthly basis, just to kind of align ourselves to actually who we are. I don't think we give that enough value, for sure.
Well, I always, you know, share with people that don't be like me. Don't wait until you have a really irreversible health crisis to start listening to your body, because that's what it took. I kept getting messages and messages and messages from my body and ignored it. I ignored the knock until, you know, literally the door was broken down and, you know, landed on my head. And, you know, many people have this experience that, you know, unfortunately, the way that we're designed as human beings, maybe we don't tend to listen until we're in the middle of a crisis. And that's why crisis is an opportunity for reinvention. Yeah. But I still say, don't wait until that moment. Don't be like me. Don't do like I did, you know?
Yeah. My second last question is about authenticity and how in today's digital world are you able, or how do you find ways to truly stay authentic to yourself and to who you want to be? I've noticed that you've started doing a lot of these talks on multiple causes that you are passionate about and multiple things, topics that you are passionate about. How do you stay true to yourself and your authentic self without thinking too much about, you know, your image and your society? Because you come with all of that as well. And it's not, you're not just a regular person. How does that have, you know, how do you deal with that?
I think all of us have things to say, you know. All of us have these stories deep inside or a mission. And I think rather than thinking about what you should not be doing, focus on that. And that kind of leads the way. And I do have to share, though, that recently what was happening on social media. Now, first, let me foreground this by saying I really don't like social media very much. Even though it's part of our life, and certainly I've benefited from it. And it's just something that you almost have to do when you have a service or something to share with the world. But, you know, for instance, on my Instagram, I was kind of like losing life on it. I was just sort of plodding along. And in the back of my head, I said, I'll keep this up because of my book, my next book. You know, when you promote a book, at least you need a platform. Like, even today in the publishing world, they ask, oh, how many followers does she have? Like, that's what the world has come to. So I was literally doing that in the back of my head for that, and also for my platform that I started, the Upside Space, the digital art platform, you know, just as a way, a voice of connecting with these audiences. And then I just sort of woke up one day, and as I said, you know, my best moments have happened when I've lost that fear but also that kind of apathy with what I'm doing. I was feeling very apathetic about it. And I said, how do I bring more of my authentic self to this platform? Because this is ridiculous, you know? It feels fake and forced.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to put that out there. You know,
yeah.
What's the point? Yeah. Try to be authentic in every other part of my life. And then, you know, and people do tend to read you through this for better or for worse, you know? And so I said, you know, screw it. Let me just start talking about things that are important to me that I've always talked about. I mean, here's the thing. I've always, I think, put out a lot of taboo topics. I think I was one of the first Indian personalities to talk about my cancer or a cancer diagnosis. I was the first to go public with that. That was 2009. I spoke about my surrogacy. I've been actually very open about so many things. I've spoken about mental health issues. My book is very, very frank and open. And I said, why am I doing this on this platform? Let me stop being so also lethargic about it. So I just said, let me start this series where I can talk about what I call taboo topics and choose a topic and just talk about it. Because as I said, I still give a lot of public talks, and they really, really revitalize me. They really energize me. I love speaking to a live audience. But that's obviously a very small group of people in general. And I thought it would be really interesting to open it up and just put it out there and just be myself, really. And actually, I'm a bit goofy. I have a really horrible sense of humor. I'm probably my daily personality is a bit different from probably how people perceive me. And I'm a bit of a nerd as well about things. So I focused rather than the hesitation. There was a little hesitation. I just focused on what I wanted to put out there and tried to have fun with it. And it's actually, I'm having a blast, and I'm now thinking about the next. The first topic that I started with was menopause.
Menopause, yeah.
That's something I have personal experience with. And it's for some unknown reason, even though more than half of the population goes through this, and most women spend a third of their life in menopause, we don't talk about it. Yeah. We talk about getting your period. Girls are prepared for their menstruation career, but not for their menopause career. And again, it doesn't make any sense. So I just put it out there, and I've had a blast, and I've connected with some great people. And so I'm going to keep this series going as long as I can.
I love that. It's so real and so authentic, even though the word authentic is kind of overused. I just feel like it's so raw and real that it's refreshing to see from a person like you with you know, where you come from and with your career. I just feel like it's going to help a lot of people connect a lot more. I feel like that connection is what we need a lot more. We idolize a lot of people, and we see so much in a perfect sense. But I feel like just seeing all of this will bring out so much more of a stronger connection. And it's so exciting.
And so thank you. I'm so glad you're the first person that I'm talking to about this, actually, in this this way since I started doing this. And I agree with what you say. I think that, you know, social media is rife with perfect images, with airbrushed images, with people also curating their lives and putting it out there. And, you know, I think what people respond to now is that glimmer of authenticity. And it was interesting, even when we were filming one of the first little portions that I was talking about, where I was talking about my personal menopause journey, the girl that I work with, Sasha, who was recording it, was much younger, very far from menopause. Yeah. I was talking for a long time. And, you know, again, people, like, attention span is very, very limited.
Yeah.
Up at the end of it, and I said, is that too long? What was I doing? And she said, no, it was good, because even though it's not relevant to me, it was so honest and it just felt really real. And I'm hemming and hawing and using my hands a lot and not, you know, trying to control, I guess, the discussion, just seeing what comes out organically. And that's always just slightly frightening, but so much more fun and real. And that's how we are used to communicating. So why not put it as well?
Yeah, I love it. I'm excited. Do you have anything other than this, of course, that you have coming up that you'd like to share with our listeners before we sign off?
Well, the digital art platform, the Upside Space, that I co-founded and I was working my ass off on earlier this year, we're going to be celebrating 1 year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm super proud of what we've created. We've created a platform that focuses on artistic traditions from Southeast Asia, South Asia, and the Middle East, or the Global South, in a sense. and really sort of tried to bridge traditional arts with the digital realm. And I'm very passionate about art. That's another thing that I love doing. I've been a collector and just an art aficionado for many years. So it was really satisfying to work with a fantastic team and put this together. So 1 year, and we have to keep going. It's a difficult market right now, to be honest, but doesn't matter. We're really passionate about what we're doing. And I like to think that we're also a platform for discovery and discourse as well. It's not just about buying the art, but actually opening people's eyes to incredible diversity of art that there is from these regions and the stories as well. So happy about that. Yes, working on my next book. And hopefully I'm setting myself a deadline of the end of this year. So trying to carve out some time every day. Yeah. Writing is my primary passion. So I'm very excited about that. And I'll continue with the taboo topics. I'm kind of having a blast with that, as I said, just like throwing it all out there and seeing what happens. And we're gearing up for the end of the year. It's kind of surreal. So taking stock, but also just want to have a blast with my kids. And for myself. Yeah, so much fun. And looking at early next year, we're, building a little house in the Nilgiris as well. So I want to be able to have my little writing meditation getaway. India is always a big part of my life. So these things are really important. And look, praying for peace. It's been a very, very destabilizing time. Mm-hmm. And I think also as a mother, I wake up weeping, or, I can't help it. Like, it's a really, really difficult time. And I do think that that's almost like our duty as human beings. There's a really interesting organization called Zen Peacemakers. And they actually look at places of trauma in the world and invite their community to pray, and pray for. And I think it's just about that, and express gratitude for what we have right now. Yeah. Because it's just been nuts what's going on in the world. It's just nuts. And, I'm not going to, state anything more than that, but we all know it's just completely nuts.
Yeah. Like
I want to hug my kids tight every time I see certain news items.
Yeah.
And let's just hope that there's some sort of resolution.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really soon.
Yes. All right. Thank you so much, Lisa. I have taken so much of your time.
I forgot one more thing.
Sure.
Yeah. Sure. Looking at starting a podcast actually with a friend here.
Oh, that's exciting.
Life in the fabulous 50s. So.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
Process.
I've been listening to a podcast called Nourishing the Mother by two Australian friends who do it.
Okay.
Just like, kind of issues that you deal with is something that they talk about, like boundaries, for example, setting boundaries with your kids and all of that. But it's so fun to hear two friends talk about life of a, in a particular topic, that it's so exciting that you're going to be doing this. I think it's so fun. I mean, I'm obviously will not relate because I'm not yet there, but that is exciting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and she's my bestie. We've known each other since we were probably like 16 in Bombay, but she's been in Dubai for like the last, 10, 12 years. Sujata Asumal, was the founding editor of Harper's Bazaar India. And it's really interesting because we are such close friends for so many years. And for some reason, people are very surprised when they find out that we're friends. I think we're like, people see us as diametrically opposite, because Suj is like, she's just such a fashionista diva and, very beautiful and well put together and proper. And I'm a bit more bleh, but we're good buddies. So let's see what happens with that.
Nice. Congratulations. We're looking forward to that for sure.
Thank you. We'll have you on.
Yes, for sure. I'd love to be a part of it.
I love that. I've already thought of an episode where, you know, we want to talk about intergenerational perspectives and relationships.
Yeah, that would be really fun. But thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation with me. It's been something that I've been wanting to do for the past month or so, and I'm so glad we were able to do this.
No, I'm sorry. I've been like a little bit troublesome and like pinning down.
No, but I'm so glad that we were able to do it.
I appreciate you made the time with your 18-month
old. Everything's going on. Yeah.
I'm so glad we could do this. And this is like a really nourishing, fun conversation as well.
I'm glad.
If you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget to subscribe to the Ikivi podcast, a space for discussion on living meaningful and fuller lives each day. The Ikivi podcast is a property edited and produced by the team at Ikivi.